Welcome to the Bike Show here on Resonance FM with me, Jack Thurston. This is your weekly half-hour slice of life on two wheels. And this week on the show, we're picking up where we left off last week, which was somewhere south of the Vauxhall roundabout. I was riding with Pete Gostolo, recently back from a very long journey by bicycle, the length and breadth of the African continent. Pete is what you might call an adventure cyclist. He rode 20,000 miles and passed through dozens of countries, showing, if there was ever any doubt about it, and there certainly isn't any doubt about it here on the Bike Show, that the bicycle is the best way to travel. Last week on the show, we talked about the bike. We talked about his motivations for riding. And this week, we talk about day-to-day life on the road. So saddle up, and for the next half hour, enjoy the ride. Well, we're now down on the River Thames, on the south side of the Thames, opposite Dolphin Square, where lots of MPs have their London residence. And behind us is the building works, which I believe is where the new US Embassy complex is going to be. And Pete has just emerged from the bushes, where he's been having a call of nature.
Back in Africa now, I was absolutely bursting for the toilet. It's not so easy to find somewhere in central London as it is in in most of Africa, actually. Yeah. But I'm feeling better now.
Well, a tanned, swarthy-looking man with a rugged bicycle, you probably wouldn't be able to get away with being suspicious in the bushes in about 2 years once the embassy is in full working order. You'll have a squadron of Marines parachuting themselves out of the sky to bundle you into some rendition unit.
Yeah, that would be a bit embarrassing. That bush has had quite a good water, I can tell you that.
I mean, let's talk about day-to-day life on the road. Where were you staying on your journey? Were you camping?
Yeah, it was a total mixture of places. That time on the road, I would say that probably about 30% of the time I was camping. And those places I was camping, they were a mixture of being totally out in the bush alone, but more commonly in Africa, actually going into small villages and asking permission from basically village elders, chiefs, school headmasters, church pastors, permission to camp. And 9 times out of 10 I was always welcomed open arms, actually. Other places, other African countries, accommodation could be quite cheap, like local accommodation. So I'd stay in basic guest houses. And then there were other places in the cities where, because I was actually doing some fundraising, I was fundraising for an organization helping with malaria, and I kept a website. The internet was a great resource and a means to be able to network with people. And so, you know, I got put up by expats who were living in big cities, and it was such a contrast because, you know, they'd been living in a sort of a Western style apartment, and I'd spent the last week or 2 weeks sort of slogging it through the bush. So I stayed and sometimes I stayed in quite nice places in some of those bigger cities. So it was a mixture perhaps of those three. And then there were always other sort of random nights where, you know, I thought I might be camping, but I wouldn't be because it wouldn't be a suitable place. So somebody just, you know, allow me to put my head down at the back end of a restaurant or something like that. I suppose more interestingly for people is I never really knew on most days where I put my head down, which I suppose is quite unsettling when you think about it. There'd usually be a point in the day, sometime in the afternoon, where I'd get an idea that, okay, I'm going to arrive in that town, and because it's a town, it's most likely I'm going to find some accommodation. So I'm going to stay in some, you know, some with a roof over my head, whether it be other places where I look on the map and I'd see, well, I'm not actually going to arrive anywhere on the map, but I know just from experience that this road in this particular country is bound to have villages along the roadside. So I'll aim for one of these villages and I'll get there before it's dark, because that was another rule, general rule, that it was terrible to arrive in a place you've never been to before when it's dark. So I'd always arrive roughly sometime...
That's a kind of iron law of cycle touring, wherever you are. Arriving in the dark is just, it's so disorientating, it's so worrying, and then people, I think, look at you in a slightly different way as this sort of shady person with all these lights flashing around, and, you know, they can't get a good look at you and size you up, can they?
Yeah, there'd be times, you know, I remember in somewhere on the Kenyan-Tanzanian border, and of course when the sun goes down in Africa, it gets dark quite quickly, and the other thing is, you know, you ask people directions and distances and you get the common response of not far or just over there, and of course it's always much further. But there was one particular occasion where the sun had gone down, and I think a guy on the roadside had said it wasn't far, and I ended up arriving in this village in the dark, and my lights on my bike were woeful. I used to have a head torch, a camping head torch, and I sort of rode into this village with the head torch on, and of course, you know, you ride up to somebody and they can't see you, so then you shine the lights on your face and they realize that you're not a local black African, you're a white guy on a bicycle, so there's this kind of shock. And it's always so much harder because you can't orientate yourself, and it's difficult to sort of judge the people around you as the guy you're talking to, as you had a few drinks and all these sort of things. So I'd always try to arrive before it got dark, and it made me feel safer. But most of the time, yes, I never exactly knew where I'd going to be. But in the capital cities, in the cities which I needed to go into for to use banks or the internet or apply for visas, more often than not, I would have made contact with somebody living there, and I would know that I'm going to stay with that person. And that was quite welcoming because I'd often be met in the city, and then you know, I wouldn't be having to sort of navigate my way around this big, confusing third world city, really. Yeah.
And then in terms of feeding and watering yourself, were you cooking food, buying ingredients, or were you relying on street food and stuff you could buy, or powdered mashed potato? Yeah. Did you have one pannier stuffed with dehydrated food? And what were you doing?
It was only in South Africa that I got onto Smash. No, most of the journey, again, I'd say 50-50. Half of the time, well, I carried a multi-fuel stove, places where I knew I couldn't get street food. You know, I would carry the simple basics of rice, pasta, and you know, tinned fish, quite basic. But other places, East Africa, and also in the Congo and parts of West Africa, there is street food, and it'd often be much easier just to actually to go into, I won't say a restaurant, but like a roadside eatery or a shack, and see the food being cooked on the street and eat it there and then, rather than faff around with getting everything out and preparing it. But making a long journey, I always had to have a multi-fuel for the times where I needed to sort of self-cater. Yeah.
And did you find that the food varied a great deal, or was it kind of monotonous, the same stuff again and again?
Yeah.
And how did you cope with that?
Yeah, so it was a bit of monotony. I mean, a lot of fried chicken in places. Rice is a staple, just as I can say fufu or ghali, which is basically mashed up or ground cassava, which is like a white paste, and it's often eaten as a staple alongside, well, it could be goat meat, it could be beef, it could be fried chicken. Yeah, I mean, nobody travels, I think, in Africa expecting great delightful cuisine unless you pay a lot for it. I mean, along the coast and along big rivers, of course, you'd have fresh fish, which was something different. I think looking back, the things that stand out about perhaps the food was more the fresh fruits. I mean, on a daily basis through many countries, you would cycle along and you would see these roadside stalls, you know, stretching for hundreds of meters, stacked up with pineapples or mangoes or whatever the seasonal fruit was, and you always knew that, of course, it was going to taste much better than anything you'd buy from a supermarket here, and it would cost a fraction of the price. And you know, I never got tired of all that fresh fruit. I used to love cycling along the coast, and there'd be, you know, kids, you know, selling coconuts, and there'd be one little boy with a little machete, and he'd just crack the top of the coconut open, and you've got your coconut juice. And you know, I loved all that. Yeah.
Do you have any perception about how you were regarded by people? Is there a concept of traveling for the experience, traveling for tourism, you know, in the traditional old sense of the word tourism, to go for a tour rather than to, you know, go and look at the pyramids or lie on a sun lounger all day? Because I would imagine that most people in Africa, their travel is fairly functional. It's they're traveling to work, or they're traveling between relatives or that kind of thing, rather than just making a journey for recreation, because, you know, people probably don't have a lot of money to do that kind of
absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely, particularly in places where there was no tourist industry. I mean, if you're in a town or a destination where you're just another foreigner, you're another tourist. But in most of Africa, particularly on the bicycle, that wasn't true. So one of the most common questions, you know, I got asked was, "What's your mission?" And you know, if I'd said I'm a tourist, well, it would make no sense because they couldn't understand that that's what it was. So, you know, I'd often explain the reason I was traveling was to learn more about these countries. There was part of the fundraising aspect and to see and meet people. So yes, there was incredible curiosity. I mean, I remember actually in the Congo and a few other places where bicycles were used by people to transport and sell things, people would see me and they'd see all the bags on the bike and they'd look at the bags and they'd ask each other, you know, what is this guy selling? And then somebody would come forward and, you know, they'd say, what are you bringing to us? Which might have been like I was coming to distribute some form of gifts, because I the other thing about Africa, the whole aid agencies where, you know, I suppose foreigners traveling to remote villages are somehow associated with bringing something, whether it be knowledge or wealth, or, you know, you're coming with your bags filled with things. But often people just thought I might be selling something from my bags. So yeah, it's very interesting when I look back on all those places I went through, and I think I wonder what they actually they thought. And I could imagine that in places where not many people go through, they'll always remember this crazy foreign white guy who came through on a bicycle. But for me, it was just another sort of day on the road, really.
So were you kind of moving on all the time, or were there places where you decided to have a break and kind of get to know a place a little bit better? Because there is a kind of relentlessness about being constantly on the move, where you feel like all the places just blur into one, and you get a kind of traveler fatigue if you're not careful, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I traveled generally quite slowly. You know, I spent 2.5 years in Africa. If I'd wanted to travel from the north to the south, I could have done it in less than 6 months quite easily, but I would have finished feeling that I hadn't seen or learnt nearly as much as I have done spending a lot longer. I would never really spend more than one or two nights in some of those quite remote places in small villages, because, you know, I always felt that these were places that, unless I was meeting somebody or there was something going on there, it was just a place to rest my head. It was more the towns, some of the places where I could plan ahead and say, right, you know, I've cycled for a week and I need to rest, I need to, you know, update my website, or I need to do something to the bike. And I would say, okay, I'll spend 3, 4, 5 days. But sometimes I spent longer, sometimes I spent a week and sometimes 2 weeks in a place. And that was great because you get to relax and you get to meet people and, you know, you make friends. And it's actually quite hard sometimes deciding, okay, I'm going to continue and go, because then it all starts all over again. You're a stranger in another place. But that's travel. Yeah.
I mean, as a long distance cyclist, you are part of the same category as these guys who go around the world like as fast as they can to try and set a new world record. I mean, what's your opinion on those kind of journeys?
That's utterly different, and it's becoming a bit more common in recent years, because there's quite a few people who sort of crack out and try to, you know, cycle around the world as fast as possible. And when I first heard about these sort of journeys where, you know, guys would cycle, you know, more than 100, 150 miles a day. And recently, I think, you know, this year, a new world record was set, somebody cycling 200 miles on average a day. It doesn't really fit into the same category. I mean, you're spending your entire time on the road, staring down at tarmac. And the roads that you'd be cycling on would be pretty terrible roads, because they would be the most direct and the equivalent of cycling along the main, you know, the M1 for the duration of your trip. And you, of course, the interaction you have with people in those countries is going to be much more superficial than the interaction I had. You would stop to buy a Coke or whatever it would be, probably not even recognize what currency you're parting with, and then continue on. So you know, I take my hat off to guys who go out and do that.
Why do you take your hat off? Isn't it entirely pointless?
there is a pointlessness to it, but it's, I mean, effectively, yeah, you could ride your bicycle around a velodrome for, you know, several days non end and say that you've broken the world record. I mean, you still have to interact with people, people from different countries who speak different languages, and you have to deal with the bureaucracy, and I know from experience that sometimes you can sort those things out by paying money if you wanted to, which I never did. Yes, there is a bit of a pointlessness to it, but to still go off and do it by yourself, you know, to cycle independently through Iran or Pakistan and be pulled up by those guys at checkposts, you know, with guns. And, you know, I sometimes felt that I was so green-eyed when I arrived at these places. Well, these guys who would have left England a month or two earlier would have been far more green-eyed. I mean, you know, one of the lessons I learned quite quickly traveling through all these countries is if I could just learn the basics of each language, the greetings, just to greet somebody or say thank you, it made a tremendous difference. And, you know, going around the world in 100 days or whatever, you probably wouldn't have time even to know what language they're speaking. And to learn the basics was, for me, really important. And anybody else who was setting off doing that, there are things like that which require more time, because, you know, things that you would be practicing or learning off the bike. And, you know, for me, in a month on the road, all I could say that 15 of those days, you know, between 10 and 15 of those days, I might actually be off the road. And that, you know, I think those days are just as important as the days cycling, because they're the days that you actually learn about places you're going through. Whereas if you're spending 10, 12 hours on the road every day, you burn yourself out so quickly. And yeah, like you said, it's a bit pointless. I think you described it well enough there. Yeah.
All right, well, let's wend our way along the river towards the last hues of the setting sun. We can see that over Chelsea Bridge. We've got Battersea Power Station up ahead of us. We might just ride along the pavement here, see how we get on with that. How's your brake squealing or mine? Right, well, this does seem to be a mixed-use pavement, one of the legendary crap cycle lanes of Great Britain.
Lane, is it?
Well,
it is,
there's
yeah.
Some paint
it's got
down
cones
there.
Cones all along it, and I don't think there's much space for runners and cyclists on.
Well, there's a cement mixer as well.
And a large bin I'm about to crash into. Yeah.
Is this guy coming backwards? All right, we'll, you know, manage this. And then there's a great bit where the cycle lane is painted around the lamppost.
Well, yeah, I suppose you've got to keep your eyes on the road ahead of you. I actually, funnily enough, collided into a lamppost like that about a week ago. I put new tyres on the bike, and the tyres that I'm running are much slicker. And I used to be able to sort of mount pavements at an angle, but now if I do that, the bikes would slide along, and that's what happened, and I slid into a lamppost, which for anybody watching must have been quite humorous.
I mean, this is an insane road. This is Nine Elms for anyone familiar with this part of southwest London. And look, I mean, let's just stop here a moment and actually look at this road. So over on the far side, there's a kind of green tree-lined area and a sort of Royal Mail sorting office. Here we've got a great big wide pavement, and then there's a very wide road, a bus lane, and a central reservation. I mean, there has got to be space on a road of this size for a good 2 meters of bike lane on either side, in either direction.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree. You know, more bike lanes, the better.
And better bike lanes.
And better bike lanes, yeah. This is a total mess. It's not really set up for cyclists at all. So yeah, there needs to be a bit of work done on this road, I think.
Bye. By Kringle Dock, which is the municipal dump for the London Borough of Lambeth and maybe London Borough of Wandsworth as well. And opposite us is New Covent Garden Market, which is one of the central wholesaling markets for flowers and vegetables and fruit. Did you ever have any sort of really difficult moments where you felt like your life might be about to come to an end?
A few, actually. There are a few off the bike. There was one on the bike when I was cycling through the Sahara, and I'd stopped at a petrol station just to fill up with water, and about 10 dogs came in, and they all seemed quite sleepy to begin with, but when I pulled out of the petrol station they all came out and got wildly excited by me getting on the bike and cycling off. And you know, these are sort of 10 wild feral dogs, and the faster I cycled the closer they came, and I realized that I had to get off the bike, and I started pushing the bike along the road, and they'd stop barking then, but they just follow me. And this went on for about 20 minutes, and I thought the dogs would sort of give up and just walk back, but they didn't. Eventually a car came along out of the distance, and I slowed it down, and there was a French guy in there with dreadlocks, and he had bloodshot eyes. He'd definitely been smoking something, and he had a Moroccan driver, and I thought I might put the bike on the roof, but the driver thought it'd be more sensible that I held on to the roof of the car with my right arm and then hold my left arm on my bike, and he tow me along. Well, in theory it sounded like a good idea, but he started off going at about 15 miles per hour, which was manageable, but then he basically sped right up to about 40 miles an hour, and I was still holding on, and I was leaning into the car, I'd lost balance, and there were still two dogs chasing. I tried to communicate with the driver, but it was far too windy and he couldn't hear me. And I had this sort of life flashing before my eyes moment, you know, and I very quickly let go of the car and sort of got my balance back. The car started disappearing ahead of me, and I just had the bike in top gear and started pedaling like crazy, and eventually the last dog gave up the chase. But for a moment I could just see me and the bike landing on the ground, and imagining one of these dogs mauling me. So that was definitely a moment of, of fear and death being quite close.
Well, let's take our chances with the mean streets of Battersea.
Anzanga, sindizi wa chifukwa, simu akondela. Amalume chifundo ine kumutima kala nitete asieni muasie choncho. Chani uniuze chifu kwa chache amalume. Chani simu kondela andanga aba ine nanzanga kuchokela na pamene ine ninali mungono. Nalu sevela nanzanga.
Well, we've arrived safely to the haven of Battersea Park, and we're now on the nice smooth tarmac on the cycling and sort of running bit that goes around the park.
Yeah,
it is very smooth actually. It looks like it must have been recently paved. You mentioned you were doing something for malaria.
Yeah.
What? Tell us about that.
Well, before I set off through Africa, I realised that doing a big journey like I was, it was an opportunity to fundraise and raise awareness. And of course, Africa, well, there's lots of problems. But I struck upon an organisation called the Against Malaria Foundation, and with malaria being, you know, such a big killer through many of the countries I was going through, and the fact that the organization existed mostly, well, entirely to provide mosquito nets to prevent malaria, which is one of the best means to prevent it, it was a very tangible thing. The fact that I could ask people to donate money and all of it went on buying mosquito nets, and as I went through Africa, I was able to team up with local partners there who were helping to distribute some of the nets which people had fundraised for, and it all came together quite well, really. I mean, I sort of set off with a vague sort of fundraising target in mind, and I managed to give some talks in schools, international schools in Africa, and it provided opportunities of networking and connecting with new people.
So was that sponsorship of your ride, or what kind of thing was it? How does that work? Because, you know, I've got quite ambivalent views about sponsorship, because I kind of see bicycling as a very pleasurable thing to do. Yeah. And it's like, why should someone make a payment to something in order for me to go on a nice holiday trip?
Not at all. I mean, the journey was entirely self-financed. I think some people perhaps got confused that when they donated money, it was going to my sort of on-the-road expenses. Not entirely. The trip was all financed by myself, and I basically decided I was going to fundraise for this organization. So when people provided money, it went entirely on mosquito
bed. So what's the ask? It's like, I am doing a bike ride, give some money to combat malaria. I just don't see the connection.
Well, you know, my first big journey where I cycled across, you know, Asia and North Africa, and, you know, I did no charity fundraising at all. And I suppose, personally speaking, I mean, it's very interesting, you know, coming from England, when people undertake these big journeys, there's always this sort of sense that, well, you must be doing it for charity, you know. It's almost part of the British psyche that, you know, if you're going to cycle a far way or climb a mountain, you'll do it for charity. And
And part of me thought, well, I've been half bullied into doing it. But then I thought, well, wait a minute. You know, if this is how a lot of people feel, and I am doing this big journey, then it does no harm whatsoever to use the journey to fundraise and raise awareness. You know, and it wasn't the chief motivating factor for me to make that journey. You know, if, you know, when I hear people being interviewed and they say, why are you doing it? And they say, I'm doing it for charity. Well, you know, I know that's a load of rubbish, because you're mostly doing it for yourself. But if you're doing something that captures people's attention, and particularly through a place, you know, like Africa, where there are various problems, and you know, I'm quite cynical when it comes to aid in charity anyway, and that was one of the reasons why I spent quite a lot of time looking at what I wanted to fundraise for, because the money wasn't going on, you know, providing fuel for a fleet of fancy, you know, 4x4 vehicles. All the people who are involved in that organisation do it voluntarily anyway. So the money goes on bed nets, and bed nets over people's heads in Africa, it's very simple. It, you know, prevents people from getting malaria and effectively dying. So I didn't allow myself to get too caught up in the sort of ethics of aid and charity giving.
I mean, my problem is obviously not with saying to people, make a donation, yeah, and encouraging them to make a donation and saying, well, you know, you're a friend of mine and I'm going to Africa. Africa's got these, yeah, problems with malaria. You know, let's do it like that. My problem is with people doing the London to Brighton, uh-huh, and sort of getting sponsorship, because I think it sends out an image about cycling, that cycling is arduous and difficult and something that you need to be encouraged to do because you're raising money for, yeah, charity, yeah, like something unpleasant.
Yeah.
And it's not something unpleasant. It can be something unpleasant if you try to do something that's beyond your capabilities, and that will lead people to sort of do their London to Brighton, mm-hmm, and go, bloody hell, I'm never going to do that, yeah, again, because, yeah, that was 55 miles more than I was ready for, and right, ultimately they'll be put off cycling. So I kind of think there's this whole industry around sponsored rides that is actually doing nothing for cycling more widely, which I think is probably the highest priority, really.
Yeah, no, I partly agree with you. I mean, I would have made the journey regardless. If somebody had said, I'm afraid you can't do this for charity, I wouldn't have said, well, I'm not doing it. I was going to do it anyway. It gives you motivation when people take an interest in what you're doing. It's just like, you know, why would you keep a website? Why would you write a blog? Well, there is a part of an ego thing about it. It's nice when you know that people are following you. But yes, I mean, there are plenty of people who do equally adventurous things from other countries who do it for the sake of doing it. You know, you live your life and you do what you want to do, and people from other nationalities, they don't get quite so embroiled in the whole charity aspect of things.
Just past the Peace Pagoda in Battersea Park, and we've got a view of the Thames from the Shard over there, right the way past the twinkling lights of Chelsea Bridge, and here right in front of us the shimmering reflection of Albert Bridge. The lights have just come on and it's getting darker in London. We've got a beautiful weeping willow on the left here.
houseboats across the way. This is a very beautiful spot, isn't it? And what I'm leading up to is homesickness.
And
missing things about the place that you're from when you're out on the road. Did you have moments when you would conjure up in your mind a scene such as this? Maybe you've got different scenes, you know, a nice afternoon at Durdle Door on the Dorset coast, and you think, what am I doing here? And your heartstrings are being tugged back to the old country.
Yeah, I don't think it's so much a feeling of homesickness, because I always associate homesickness as, you know, you feel like you're missing some food or a pub that you used to frequent or something like that. It's more the feeling of familiarity and peace that you can, particularly with traveling in a place like Africa, you're always fully aware that you know, you're a stranger and things can be unsettling around you. Whilst, you know, when I'm back in England, and now that I'm back, and there are sort of places where I could just sit on a bench in a park and know that nobody was going to give me some problems, and I wouldn't have to be quite so aware of my surroundings. So there's a feeling of calmness now that I've come back. But when I was out on the road, I think I'm just somebody who's always thrived on being in unknown places and being a bit of a curiosity for the people that I meet. You know, the thing about the interesting thing when you do come back here, whether you're living in London or a small village or town, is that, you know, everybody's life just goes on here, and you're nobody in the sense that you can be anonymous and nobody would know that you've just spent the last 2 or 3 years traveling across the continent. Whereas when you're actually traveling, the people you meet, they're always much more engaged in your journey because you're undertaking it at that time and you're excited to talk about it. Of course, when I do come back and I meet people who have an interest in travel or an interest in Africa, there's nothing more pleasurable than, you know, spending an evening telling a few yarns over a few drinks.
And was there a high coming back, or was it actually quite the opposite, that you felt a sort of feeling of emptiness and a lack of purpose because you weren't sort of going onwards and onwards and onwards?
Well, it's the second time, so I knew how it would be. The first time I came back, having cycled back to England from Japan, there was this euphoria of arriving back and having crossed all these countries by myself and coming back. But then quite quickly you realise that once you're back and people know that you're back, everything just sinks back into how it was before. So this time around, coming back from Africa, I mean, I didn't ride back onto UK shores. I arrived, you know, rather unceremoniously at Gatwick Airport with my mum, just came to pick me up. I arrived on the bike and, you know, there was no fanfare, and I didn't really want that anyway. And I'd been back before, so I knew that, you know, I would sort of see some faces and catch up with friends and family. But then everything just sort of sinks back into how it was before. And once you sort of accept that and realise that's how it's going to be, then that's fine, really. Of course, the longer you spend back here, the more your trip somehow becomes a bit more of a distant memory. But it was very good that, you know, I kept a website, a blog, and now it's the plan to write that into a book. And I need to do it, you know, sooner rather than later, because otherwise the freshness of the experiences starts to fade away.
And do you feel like you've got big journeys out of your system after the second one, or are you going to be off and doing you know, the length of the Americas?
I never say never. I mean, there's, at the moment I'm not planning another big trip. I mean, I think I'll be somebody who always makes journeys in foreign countries, sort of adventurous journeys, but they might not be for quite the same length of time. You know, I want to write a book now, and it's probably going to be a bigger challenge in some respects than the actual cycling itself. But I think in the future, yeah, I'd like to do some more trips, but perhaps not the same length, you know, sort of shorter, you know, 1, 2, 3 month trips, because you can put a lot into that and then come back. And because sometimes when you're on the road for a very long time, things become so familiar that you don't appreciate them in the same kind of way. You've seen so many amazing beaches or so many interesting markets that just seeing the sight of somebody carrying a bed on the back of his bike no longer impresses you, because you've seen it half a dozen times. And you really need to remind yourself that that's actually something quite amazing, and you only get that when you sort of change your environments and come back to what was familiar, I think.
And so you're probably in quite a good position to offer a bit of advice to those of us who are never gonna do such a long journey as you've done, in how we can get the most out of the cycle touring that we do, whether it's you know, an evening ride, maybe an overnight trip that I'm very keen on, or a weekend tour, or like you've just done coast to coast. How do you take the spirit of adventure and deploy it in a more domestic setting that isn't sort of a world-shaking journey?
Sure. I think the beauty of cycle touring anywhere is your freedom, and you know, you can follow a guidebook religiously and say, well, the author says turn left here or turn right, but that's never as exciting as just taking a map and having a bit of a knowledge of the direction you want to go, but then saying, oh wow, look at that, you know, let's go this direction, and then you're there and you think, well, I wonder if anybody else came here, or let's take that road, let's go that way. It's the beauty and the freedom to do it. So, you know, for me, when I explain or tell someone else about what I've done, and they want to have everything planned down to a T, I say, well, you know, forget all that. Have some knowledge of your limitations about how far you think you can ride in a day and so forth. But just let the spirit of adventure sort of carry you through, and be prepared to take new roads or experience or venture to new places that might not have been written about before.
That's excellent advice from Pete Gostolo. I was riding with him, and you can find out more about him online. His journey across Africa, also his journey across Asia, he did a few years before that, and that's at petergostolo.com or via the Bike Show's website, www.thebikeshow.net. Well, that is it for 2012 on The Bike Show here on Resonance FM. There may be one or two fragments on the podcast for those of you who listen to the show via the podcast between now and the end of the year. But that is the end. This is the end of the season on Resonance FM. I'll be back again in the new year. So until then, stay warm. And keep the rubber side down. Goodbye.